Welcome to Workforce Inside, the podcast for business leaders looking for fresh insights and solutions to today's most pressing workforce challenges. I'm your host, Bhushan Sethi, joint global people and organization leader at PwC. In each episode, you'll receive new ideas from experienced practitioners who are helping employers drive workforce transformation. In February, PwC commissioned one of the largest global surveys of the workforce. People revealed a mostly optimistic story, but one with some concerning undercurrents. Workers reported feeling excited or confident about the future. In this episode, we'll discuss the issues surrounding the digital divide and the societal and economic benefits of greater private-public collaboration on upskilling and reskilling. Joining me today is Alexandra Hom, a senior manager in our workforce strategy practice, and Mike Pino, a partner in our strategic change team. Welcome, Alexandra and Mike.
Thanks, Bhushan. It's so awesome to be here.
Thanks, Bhushan. Glad to be here.
Great. So, Alexandra, let's start with you. The most fun question. What's the first concert you ever attended?
I think it's a very telling question. It was a Christina Aguilera concert back in, let's say, 2000 for her debut tour as a pop artist. And believe it or not, this was back in the time when we had to call Ticketmaster and be very patient to purchase tickets. So it made me reflect on how digitally savvy we've come today. Bless my parents for being so patient with me as a preteen.
Fun. And Mike, your first concert?
We'll probably get up with Christina Aguilera. I wish I were that young. Mine's a few decades before it with the Police on the Synchronicity tour. It was a good show.
I've had the very, very good pleasure of meeting Sting on an aeroplane. So wonderful. And thank you for taking us back and highlighting some of the generation gap there. So let's get into our survey. It's been really important during the pandemic to really understand the sentiment of the workforce. We polled 32,517 people across 19 countries, across all industries, all types of workers and all generations. And there were some really telling findings. By and large, there's confidence, but there's also a huge element of fear. And whatever industry you're in, whatever country you're in, for me, there's something that every business leader working with their communities and their policymakers can take something away from this. So, Mike, if I start with you, what were your reflections as you went through some of the data?
So the data is extremely rich and extremely valuable. There's a lot of richness here for policymakers and industry leaders, business leaders alike. I think the really important thing to think about here is that there's not a single answer anymore. And what it really means is that you have to find ways to connect with people that is meaningful for your organization. That is to say that you're staying true to the purpose and values that you espouse. And it's something that actually helps people find shared value and shared meaning in. And that to me is actually the real trick and the real opportunity here.
So the positivity around upskilling. Alexandra, your reflections at top level on the data?
I saw a lot more confidence than I would have expected to see with something like a global pandemic that has really ravaged our global nations across the past year. I also was not surprised to see some of the statistics around diversity and discrimination, wellness, upskilling, changing worker preferences, but I think there's lots to dig in here.
Great. So Alexandra, let's stick with you on the differences across countries. So confidence was 50% were confident, but the real interesting elements is the countries like India and China and Saudi Arabia and the US to some degree, more confident than those like Japan and some parts of Europe. What does that tell you as a worker, as a business advisor?
I think confidence is a really interesting topic because as you think about it, it's massively important to driving economies and consumer behavior. And the statistic that you stated, right, US respondents were a lot more confident in the future of work than our global respondents. It was exactly where I'd expect us to be. And by that, I mean, we're slightly behind countries like Asia and the Middle East, whose workforces tend to skew on the younger side. And we see a higher level of confidence in the future of work there. But we're a little ahead of areas in Europe where we see second waves. We see more lockdowns in Poland, Germany, and Italy. We see disparate vaccine rollouts. And I think for people that lead global teams like you and I and Mike, or we have staff and team members in other countries, we need to make sure that we're really understanding the sentiment of our workforces. So what motivates them? How can we create plans to address and really be clear on our organization's strategy.
Thanks, Alexandra. Mike, the data here around 39% of people think their job may be obsolete in 5 years. Very consistent with what we've seen before during the waves of automation and AI over the years. As someone who's been studying the tech sector and working in this space for a number of years, what's your reflection on that data?
As a business leader, you can't apply the same kind of principles. You really want to take them and meet them at a place where it's fundamentally human. There's a lot of fear and anxiety in the workforce. And some of that fear and anxiety is justified. You know, certain types of activities are being eliminated. They're being augmented by technology. And some of them are not being eliminated. It's not as though jobs are disappearing. It's that jobs are changing. The real hard thing about it is you really have to meet people where they are. And meeting them emotionally is not the easiest thing for a lot of business leaders. But the most important thing you could do is start the conversation and start now. The more that you actually have those kinds of touch points, the more that you have that kind of dialogue, the better you're actually going to be positioned for having that sort of openness and that trust longer term.
And Mike, your reflections on that of being part of global technology organizations before you joined us, any reflections there when you look at the positivity around technology around the world?
In my experience with global teams, one of the things that I learned is that there's a few different nuances that exist, a few different kinds of trends that happen. There are types of things that happen in different geographies that you can sort of count on, that people have a sort of exposure to certain things. And that experience, that exposure to different kinds of technologies and how they actually change or open up opportunities for growth, it's kind of an interesting dilemma because it's not necessarily an age challenge, but it is an experience challenge. And one of the things that you really have to be very focused on is the opportunity to grow and the openness to grow. And that to me has been one of the challenges on global teams, is really how to help activate people toward that kind of openness.
And Alexandra, the fear and anxiety associated with any technology is not a new phenomenon. What's your advice when you work with companies around their transformation agenda on how they need to kind of manage that fear and anxiety amongst their workforce?
A handful of things come to mind. I think they need to be really clear on why they are leaning towards implementing that certain technology. What are the returns and investments? How does it tie to the broader business strategy? Having that clear, succinct message, as well as the value proposition for employees, the what's in it for me, is really critical to set upfront. Secondly, I think we really need to put together some adoption strategies to make sure that employees are very clear on how they can be completely bought in to the change and actually understand how it changes their day-to-day role, how it can elevate skills and experiences in their long-term career trajectories. And then three, I think there's a measurement aspect to this too. It's important to understand along the way, whether it be milestones or tranches of goals, how they're achieving what they set out to achieve those.
So relevant, whether we're talking about moving to the cloud, whether it's citizen-led automation of your own work or using new visualization tools, people leaning into this, firms also being transparent around how they're going to bring people along and invest in people as part of that reskilling is so critical. So let's move on to reskilling. Mike, the data told us that people want to reskill, but there's an underlying challenge here in that not everyone has access to the same reskilling opportunities, whether that's across industries or across education class. Do you want to bring that data to life a little bit for us?
There was some really interesting on the reskilling side of it. You know, 72% of the younger people are ready to learn new skills or completely retrain in order to remain employable. But 44% of those younger employees are given many opportunities to improve digital skills outside of their normal duties versus 24% of older workers. So it's a really interesting tension. There's a desire for it. You know, 72% of the younger people, 60% of the older are interested in it, are really ready to do it, want to do it, are open to reskilling, even if it would upend all the things that they're doing. And that's never a story you want to have as a business leader. You want to try to change that narrative as fast as you can, because the more that that starts to appear, anxiety quickly turns into frustration.
Thanks, Mike. And we also saw differences across industries. I saw that some industries like financial services, there was a 20% increase in the willingness and opportunity for reskilling compared to other businesses like consumer. So a real risk that we exacerbate the skills gap. across sectors, across geographies. Alexandra, as you think about the reskilling and the divide there and the sense of fear, what's our advice to companies on where to get started on thinking about reskilling for their workforce?
I actually saw a lot of complexity in the learning space. There were two data points that called out to me in particular. There were almost a quarter of respondents that mentioned that they were getting no opportunities at all from their employers to develop their digital skills outside of their normal duties, which is concerning to me given the shift to many of us working from home, not being able to return to the office. And at the same time, almost 3/4 of respondents seeing the responsibility of helping people reskill really sit with employers. And in speaking with some of my clients, I'm hearing that employees feel like there are so many sources of information, it's confusing to find the best resources for specific skills, people telling me it feels like a cacophony of resources. And at the same time, employers are really trying to manage their expense ratios and think about how they give employees enough space to reskill. I think companies need to be really clear that there are a number of skills like problem solving, adaptability, the ability to learn new skills, collaborate, that are going to continue to be really critical in this space. But also they need to be clear on what the best resources are, make sure that there's a right learning path, and also give them the space that they need to upskill themselves.
When you think about upskilling and you want to advise companies on how to get their people comfortable with being a continuous learner, an adaptive learner, what's your advice to leaders listening in today?
Everyone starts at the upskilling part, which is, it's exciting because it has direct impact. You can actually see where it's going to have lift to your organization. But if you're trying to build a workforce and you're trying to build momentum, you need to actually do a mixture of what we call up knowledge and upskill. You need to help people understand broadly how things are changing and how they can work together. That kind of knowledge kind of exercise and activity is oftentimes skipped. And it's a mistake because what you're really doing in that is you're creating a common language. The second thing that's really important to remember is really to focus on that application side of the equation, because you should never put a changed person in an unchanged process. So if you're giving someone skills and you're developing those skills, and then you put them back into the role, into the processes that they're working on, and nothing else has changed, it's going to create frustration. And so one of the things that's really important is before you actually have that exercise, what are some of the things that you're going to do differently? How can you put some incentives in place? How can you change some of the processes? Even if they're very modest, whatever you can do to actually signal this change happening on a larger kind of level, those two things are really the part of the employer and our business owners and business leaders really have to think through and be careful about.
So let's move on to discrimination. 50% of people feel that they've been discriminated at work, held back for various reasons. And it runs the range of ethnicity, generation, class, gender. Alexandra, to start with you on that topic, how would you advise companies if they were analyzing this data for their own business?
Yeah, I've been reflecting on this a lot lately. It's been particularly top of mind for our colleagues, friends, and family, given the headlines this past year, particularly around Black Lives Matter and the anti-Asian hate incidents. No matter how you slice and dice that data point by sector or geographic location, it is really hard to ignore the fact that the dimensions are so broad, whether it be race, class, age, gender, sexual orientation, disabilities, which you may or may not even be able to see, which really drives home the fact that anyone you may know may be affected by this discrimination in the workplace. And I think to answer your question, as professionals, we have a real responsibility to do things like work with leaders in the organization we work for, as well as policy developers, to drive the right workplace environment to foster diversity, whether it be your organization's values, or stress the importance of things like unconscious bias training, having tough, really uncomfortable conversations, and empathizing, listening to somebody when they want to share their pain, even at work. And also setting aside our egos a bit, challenging ourselves to have moments of introspection around what role can you play in this space where we might have mistakenly hurt someone else, what could have been done differently. And I think it's up to leaders like us to really set the tone and lead by example.
And Mike, addressing prejudice in a physical workplace is one challenge. When you see it, you feel it, you hear it. In a remote environment or a hybrid environment, how do firms do that? How do they think about that over the next 12 to 18 months?
What people have been doing that I think is kind of interesting is using employee listening tools in new ways. one of the things that they're trying to look for are trends, not just about sentiment, but trends about how they're connecting with others and where those connections are happening. So looking at the way that networks actually expand or contract, the sentiment isn't just on the individual level, but it's on the collective level. What you're really looking for is how people are connecting. One of the pieces that's really kind of interesting in this application of employee listening tools is that you start to see the underpinnings of belonging. If you don't help people belong, they won't belong.
So, Alexandra, what would your advice be to someone who's listening to this that feels they have experienced some of the prejudice that you were describing?
I think employees really need to take the space to decompress, really thinking about how it affects them in their day-to-day to make sure that mentally people have the space to, if they're comfortable with it, speak with supervisors, speak with peers, speak with mentors, to share that pain and share how uncomfortable it's making people. And I think it drives more constructive conversations.
And also there's a big role for leaders here. Leaders need to model the way and have zero tolerance. And we as colleagues need to call out as bystanders anything that we see as bad behavior in today's environment with all of our counterparties. The final point I wanted to make on the survey is around purpose. 75% of the workforce said they wanted to work for an organization that had a clear purpose. However, when we looked at that data and we asked around maximizing income, Alexandra, we saw that young people chose to maximize today's income ahead of purpose. That's a little dichotomy to what we're seeing elsewhere. How did you read that data?
It wasn't too surprising to me, Bhushan. I'm proud to be a millennial. But as I think through my peers, friends, and colleagues that are around the same age, we all want to work for purpose-driven organizations. However, I think that things like the pandemic, things like the past recessions we've been through, have driven some uncertainty in our roles, our long-term career paths and plans. And so when push comes to shove, you see people leaning towards maximizing their income, particularly in this time frame. But I think we'll see some changes as we shift into a post-pandemic world.
And Mike, you and I have both worked through a couple of economic recessions. This point around young people being worried about wage compression, looking to get into the workforce. As you reflect on this crisis that we have and we're looking to recover, any lessons learned from previous economic recessions?
So there's two things I would actually point to and say, these are the things that have really served people well in previous recessions. And the first is really to push a lot harder on building out adjacent skills to what you actually have. Those will have huge impact no matter where you go. And the second that's been really interesting is that the reinforcement of soft skills, or what some people are calling power skills. The thing I just want to kind of point out that is slightly different here is that while this is all happening, a global pandemic, we have something that's also changing as well. And this one's kind of harder to predict. And the most important thing that you could ever do is really to actually invest in yourself and believe in yourself. And I know that that sounds so vague, but the most important thing is that that sense of personal value starts from within.
And Alexandra, as you reflect and you think about the advice that you would provide to businesses based on this data set, what are your key takeaways?
Wellness has been top of mind for me, as well as my clients, some of whom are very senior HR leaders and friends. And we've all been able to save on commuting time, but we've all been shifting our traditional working hours and creeping into what has been previously considered offline time. I think that a lot of companies have been able to demonstrate agility. We're now connected more than ever. And I think we saw this in the data too. Only about a quarter of people are actually feeling like they're encouraged to take breaks, taking mental space, learning about healthy work habits. So my last reflection point on this data set is, as leaders continue to run global and very diverse teams, it's brought to mind that old adage of leading with kindness and compassion. Assuming that everyone you know is facing some sort of uphill battle that you know nothing about, keeping the psyche of employees in mind as we partner together on big tasks and transformations. And I think that business leaders need to continue checking on whether the wellness programs, childcare offerings, flexible work hours for mothers or caretakers or mental health resources are being offered, are actually making an impact to their workforces. And if not, revising them accordingly.
Alexandra and Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. It's been a great discussion. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to this episode of Workforce Insight. We couldn't possibly cover all of our survey findings, but it's available on our website, and please check that out. And for further insights on how to tackle your organization's workforce challenges, please visit our website and subscribe to this podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.